Hello and welcome to Saber, production of iHeartRadio. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about Ginger.
Yes, we are. Which I like Ginger just fine, but I have to say I have a friend who absolutely adores Ginger.
Yeah?
Yeah, she eats those ginger candies all the time. She has them in her purse and she's just constantly popping them. She eats the sushi garnish, like all of it, not with sushi, just eats it, which apparently is meant to be a palate cleanser, which makes total sense now that I've learned that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's not just garnish at all. Yeah, it's tasty.
Yeah, I feel like I never eat it. But she'll eat it if she's with me. She'll eat mine. And also, she's a redhead, and I just put that together just now.
Gingers, huh? Yeah.
Yep. And I think I've told this story before, but when I went on a boat trip for Australia, when we got on the boat, they handed us these ginger tablets for seasickness. And I can't tell if it worked or not, but I didn't get seasick. So.
Well, that's great.
That's nice.
Yeah. I use ginger for similar purposes. On an anecdotal level, I can say that in terms of like minor, like if I eat some onion or heaven forbid some kind of bell pepper situation, chewing on like crystallized ginger candies mm-hmm. is one of my favorite ways to kind of calm all that down. A cup of ginger tea I feel like helps me out. I cannot promise that it is medicinal properties at work, but I also just like ginger. So,
Yeah. And as we record this, it is the holidays. Surprise, surprise.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh.
I know. And I do associate ginger with the holidays because I feel like in the United States, we frequently use it in sweetbreads and desserts around this time. I know that mm-hmm. I do, and a lot of people in my circle do. Mm-hmm. And you can see our gingerbread episode, which as we record this, I believe we are about to re-release as classic.
Yeah, as a classic. I started using it more in savory cooking relatively recently. We usually have a knob of fresh ginger in the house, but historically speaking, I've mostly used like powdered ginger in baked goods. But it's probably one of my favorite flavors.
It's a good one. It's a good one. And recently over on Stuff No One Ever Told You, the other podcast I do, we did an episode on how to celebrate the holidays safely during your pandemic. And at the end, we did a recipe swap because a recipe swap is one of the big things that doing a like virtual recipe swap that experts are recommending. And I shared my gingerbread cookie recipe because I feel like a lot of my friends who feel that ginger is a really powerful flavor.
It is, yeah.
And maybe they want a more low-key gingerbread recipe. This is for you. It's like a soft, gingery, sweet cookie. And I love it. And I'm like shrinking in on myself as I'm thinking of it.
You are. You're just like regressing into like your little like blanket fort of memories.
Yes.
Is this the one with the pudding in it, with the butterscotch pudding in it? Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. You mentioned it in the aforementioned gingerbread episode. So.
And I have all these cookie cutters. I've got dinosaur ones and Star Wars ones because I'm a huge dork and a child at heart. So it's exciting.
I'll have to go check out that episode of Sminty and listen for that recipe, because that sounds delightful.
Yes. But in the meantime, I guess we should get to our question.
Yes.
Ginger. What is it?
Well, ginger is sort of like a tropical spicy potato.
Ooh.
Not related to potatoes. Potatoes are tubers, and ginger is a rhizome. This is maybe a bad analogy.
I liked it, though.
Cool. ginger, botanical name, Zingiber officinale, which is in the Zingerbaceae family, which means that it is related, not to potatoes, but to stuff like turmeric and galangal. It's a tropical plant that grows these fleshy, bulbous underground stems called rhizomes. And from there, the true roots shoot down and some above ground pseudostems shoot up. And more rhizomes will shoot off to the sides. And those above ground stems look a little bit like skinny green palm fronds. They'll grow maybe 1 to 4 feet tall, like a third of a meter up to over a meter. And they will flower, these really pretty yellow to red flowers, and produce seeds. But usually ginger is propagated from that rhizome, which just all around is the most used part of the plant. You might have bought a chunk of ginger rhizome. They've got like a thin brownish to reddish skin and look sort of scaly and are often shaped in these kind of pudgy, blobby, like fingery shapes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you let one of those rhizomes hang around long enough, especially just at room temperature, a little green nub of a shoot might start poking out of the skin in one or more places. And you can basically just like stick that in the ground and grow a ginger plant. I have done that.
Really?
Yeah. I've got one. It's my cat's like munching on it, which is fine.
So. Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. I didn't know. For some reason, I thought ginger would be tricky. I don't know why I thought that, but
it's you do have to keep it like moist but not wet, and it is again a tropical plant, so it doesn't really want to be in temperatures like below 50 degrees Fahrenheit, which I don't have the translation to Celsius for off the top of my head. But yeah, so you have to keep it in even such a warm climate as Georgia, you have to keep it in a pot so that you can bring it inside, for the winter. But, but yeah, inside that ginger rhizome, inside that thin, tannish to reddish skin, the flesh of it is going to be, golden yellow to pink in color, both fibrous and juicy. And with this, pungent, spicy, sweet smell and taste, like citrusy and warm and peppery and sort of like resinous or piney. And those above ground stems and leaves do have a bit of that scent and flavor too. They are totally edible, not just cats. And you can use them. You can use them sort of the way that you might use green onions, like chopped fine and added to dishes as a garnish, or to like soups or stews or stir fries toward the end of cooking. The rhizome itself can be, you're going to want to skin it probably after that. It can be chopped or grated, added fresh to sweet or savory dishes. You can steep it in hot water to make a drink to be served hot or cold. You can juice it and drink that juice. You can grind it into a paste for use as a paste, or dry that paste into a powder or extract the oils from it. Or you can process the grounds into other products like fermented beverages, or pickle the fresh slices, or boil them in sugar syrup to make a chewy candy.
Options.
Many options.
Mm-hmm.
And those many options are used in many cuisines all over the world. Northern Europe, North Asia, and North America, it's slightly more likely to be used to flavor desserts, as we were saying, whereas it's kind of more often a savory ingredient in most of the rest of the world, although both applications show up all over the place. I saw a lot of amazing looking drink recipes from East and West African cuisines that I really want to try now.
Yeah.
But if y'all have a favorite ginger recipe from your particular neck of the woods, please send it in.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Always, always, always looking for more ways to use ginger.
Yes. And what about the nutrition, Lauren?
I mean, ginger's pretty good for you. Lots of flavor for a low caloric punch. Generally, you're going to use it more as a spice than a thing that you'd like chow down a whole bunch of, unless you're talking about those ginger candies, which I've definitely chowed down a whole bunch of. And of course, you know, if you process it into a drink or a baked good or, yes, a candy, your nutritional mileage is going to vary there.
Yes.
Okay, so ginger has been used medicinally for pretty much ever, and is still used in a lot of folk and traditional medicines. And there is a lot of information and misinformation and research out there about it. There are a whole bunch of compounds in ginger that are being investigated for various medicinal applications, a lot of those compounds being the very ones that give ginger its flavors. There's a whole set of compounds named gingerols for their appearance in ginger that are being looked into. Ginger and compounds in it have been found to be antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, and antimicrobial, and may help in the prevention and management of all sorts of diseases, from cancer to like neurodegenerative stuff, to cardiovascular stuff, to respiratory stuff, to diabetes. As always, as we always say,
yes,
human bodies are complicated. More research is necessary. And before incorporating a medicinal amount of anything into your diet, talk to a medical professional about it. But I would say that in general, like if you enjoy ginger tea or like using ginger in recipes, by all means, do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ginger all the way. I have to say, this might be, it's definitely up there. I don't know if it's the number one, but it's up there in terms of when I first searched ginger, like most of the first results for pages were medicinally related.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's definitely being looked at and has been for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, and it's super fascinating because this, like with many other kind of pungently flavored things, and anything from citrus to mint to spicy peppers, like evolutionarily speaking, ginger probably hung on to the genetic code for creating lots of these molecules precisely because they're good at fighting off microbes and larger predators, aside from, you know, my cats.
Yes, the cats will not be stopped.
They apparently will not.
Oh, no ginger is safe from them. We do have some numbers for you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So ginger is a pretty popular thing. About 3 million metric tons of ginger are produced globally every year. And considering that it's a fairly lightweight product, that kind of blows my mind. The most is produced in India, almost a third, then China, Nigeria, Nepal, Indonesia, and Thailand. But the U.S. imports the most. The market value of ginger over here is like $900 million a year and growing, which I think is like almost a quarter of the global market right now.
Whew.
I think. The markets in China, Japan, Canada, and Germany are also large and growing. And the global market is predicted to hit like $8 billion by 2027, with the largest growth expected in fresh ginger.
Huh. What do you think is behind that in the U.S.? Do you think it's like our kind of health drink thing we're
on? I think it's partially that, and partially that, you know, like we have to import basically all of it. Like we don't produce that much, so it's a little bit more expensive here, so we just spend more on it. But for sure, that fresh ginger segment, related to the potential health benefits of ginger, is way up there in terms of that value.
I would also say I've seen it a lot more in drinks,
cocktails, yeah.
Separate, yeah.
Sure. Well, yeah, but both health drinks and cocktails. Yeah. I at this very current moment have a thing of ginger kombucha in my fridge. So I'm part of the problem.
Lauren Vogelbaum. we do have a lot of history for you.
We do, but first we've got a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
Back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
So, ginger probably originated in southern Asia or India at least 3,000 years ago. Some evidence suggests that a tonic from ginger root was being produced in ancient China and India over 5,000 years ago and perhaps up to 7,000 years ago. So, there's a lot of variance in that. Some historians suspect ginger was used as a flavoring agent long before records indicate. Maybe we've just lost those records or people weren't really recording it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the oldest evidence of ginger's cultivation comes from ancient Austronesian-speaking peoples in Southeast Asia. So it may have been a canoe plant. And the way they arrived at this suggestion or theory is that this, like, linguistic sleuthing— Which I really found super fascinating and was like, Annie, you have to stop. You don't have time to learn about the 26-word turmeric in this language. You've got to move on. But I thought it was really, really cool.
That's great. Yeah, I for sure it was one of the plants that made it over to like Hawaii with some of those migrations.
Yes. And as we mentioned in our gingerbread recipe, it's not gingerbread recipe, in our gingerbread episode that had my mention of my recipe, the first recipes for that appear as early as 2400 BCE, but very different, very, very different than what at least I would assume most of us think of when we think of gingerbread.
Today, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Wherever ginger originated, it spread throughout Asia and to nearby islands, to India and Africa.
And the word ginger may root, from either this ancient Dravidian word from what's now India, from maybe like 1000 BCE or earlier, or from a Sanskrit word from around the same time, which I've seen reported as being a Sringavera and a few permutations of similar phonemes. I do suspect that it's the Dravidian, because the Sanskrit is more poetic. It literally means horn body to describe the shape of the root, which is like real nice, but also rings of being a folk etymology. So at any rate, from one of these words from this area, we got Greek and Latin terms like zingiberry that then would develop into other stuff.
Horn body is definitely an insult that I'm sure has been hurled.
Hey, horn body.
Middle school playground.
I'm not sure how to picture that, though. I'm like, do you look like antlers? Like, are, like...
I suspect it's sort of in that weird in-between where you don't know what horny means.
Oh.
And you've heard horn dog. And
okay.
It's like in that weird area where you're saying an insult that you don't really know what it means.
Yeah, totally.
That's my personal opinion on this. But if anyone has a differing opinion, I mean, you're welcome to let me know, but you also don't have to. By the first century CE, India was prolifically growing ginger. Ancient Romans may have been importing ginger from India 2,000 years ago, valuing it for its believed medicinal properties. And yes, throughout history, people all over have used ginger for all sorts of medicinal purposes, in teas and soups, for colds and bronchitis, for digestive ailments, and of course, as an aphrodisiac.
Yep.
Yep. Our old pal Pliny the Elder wrote about it. For a lot of cultures, ginger was predominantly medicinal as opposed to culinary for a decent amount of time. Ginger appears prominently in traditional medicine in China and Iran, among other places. Confucius wrote about ginger in his 500 BCE writings, Analects, in which he claimed to have ginger with every meal.
Huh, okay.
It was also mentioned in the Holy Quran as one of the holy fruits awaiting the worthy in heaven, quote, and they will be given to drink there of a cup mixed with ginger. And it was pretty prized for a long time because of this. In Europe during the 13th and 14th centuries, a pound of ginger cost the same as a sheep, which I was like, well, how much did a sheep cost? Because I'm assuming it was a good amount, but I don't know for sure. And yes, that's pretty decent. And by this time, it was prized not just for medicine. Medieval Europe started importing preserved ginger for sweets, particularly. Merchant ships might have troughs for growing ginger on board their ships to aid in the digestion of the passengers and to prevent scurvy.
And the 1300s is when the English word ginger developed. Side note here, the word gingerly, as in to treat delicately or carefully, seems to have developed independently around the 1500s, perhaps from the same Latin root that gave us the word gentle.
Huh. So it didn't come from ginger. It came from... because I was thinking that's kind of opposite of ginger's whole burny thing.
because ginger is punchy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And gingerly is like not that. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right. The Spanish brought ginger with them to Central America and the Caribbean in the 1500s, and the Portuguese brought it with them to West Africa around the same time. Jamaican ginger, harvested by enslaved Africans, was highly prized for its flavor, and after England took control of Jamaica in 1655, over 2 million pounds of this ginger from Jamaica was exported to Europe a year. Some of the first records of ginger beer in England started popping up in the middle of the 1700s, pretty much just fermented sugar, water, and ginger. The ginger highball cocktail is first recorded around this time-ish, a little bit later, but close. Future episodes, though, because that would have, I would still be there.
Yes.
But a little bit more. Of course, colonists arriving in North America brought ginger and ginger beer with them, where it remained a popular beverage. England shipped a bunch of ginger beer to America from the 1790s to the 19th century.
And during the early temperance movement, a little bit later, around the 1820s, we see the term ginger ale pop up to distinguish the soft drink from the fermented ginger beer.
Right. And after Prohibition, ginger beer was surpassed by ginger ale in terms of popularity. In 1807, English botanist William Roscoe gave ginger the scientific name Zingiber officinale.
The term ginger for hair color started appearing in the, 1850s through the 1880s. I think it was just the color at first in the earlier 1800s, and then it was applied to the hair color, and then you got the noun, oh, he's a ginger, she's a ginger, towards the latter end of the century. Ginger also popped up as a girl's name in the United States in the 1910s and hit peak popularity in 1971 when it was the 187th most popular baby name, which means that it was given to about 1,670 babies that year. It is currently only the 2,828th most popular baby name, which is to say not very popular.
Do you think... Were people more going after their hair color when naming their children that? The spice? Or, you know, neither?
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. In a highly anecdotal reading about this, I saw a lot of ladies named Ginger chiming in and saying their parents had been thinking about naming them Virginia. For which Ginny or Ginger is often a nickname. But that for whatever reason, their parents didn't want to go with Virginia. So they just went straight with Ginger.
Oh, okay.
I'm like, when did Gilligan's Island come out? How much, or Ginger Rogers? I assume a lot of it is Ginger Rogers' fault.
Oh, blame Ginger Rogers. Well, this is another concern that I had when I first started searching. I was like, what if I type in Ginger and all I get is Ginger from Gilligan's Island for 8 pages? But maybe Google knows me and it knows that, of course, I'm talking about the food. I did not encounter that problem. But I was worried I was going to have to specify Ginger food.
Yeah.
Didn't.
You know, it happens sometimes.
It definitely does.
Google specificity is an entire thing.
Yes. We've talked about before about sometimes you don't do the right Google search and that's it.
Oof. Yeah. Disaster. Google disaster.
No one wants that. However, you know what I did encounter that I wasn't expecting because I've never heard of this? Something called ginger beef, which is a very popular Canadian dish. And it's that combo of ginger and beef is not new by any means, but this particular Canadian take on it goes back to the 1970s and one George Wong, the chef at the Silver Inn in Calgary. He was looking for ways to attract more folks with westernized takes on Chinese dishes. Inspired by a recipe out of North China and British pub food at large, he created ginger beef, which he described as, quote, deep fried shredded beef in chili sauce.
Ooh.
Yeah. Okay. People loved it. People loved it. In the next few decades, it made its way onto menus across Canada. However, the name is a bit misleading. People started calling it ginger beef because they thought ginger was in the sauce, but there actually wasn't, which is hilarious to me. I'm sure some versions of it have ginger in there, but like that gave me a good chuckle. Because I was like, oh, ginger beef, another avenue to go. And then it was like, well, there's not actually ginger in it. I was like, oh. Okay. Well, I'll mention it.
I wonder if he called it that because of like of maybe like some kind of like redness from the chili peppers. Yeah. And so he was talking about ginger, the color.
Well, I'm pretty sure he didn't call it that. People called it
that. Oh, just people called it that.
But maybe for those reasons, that just cracked me up. Because I don't think it said that until the end of the first article I was reading. Like, I read this, you know, multi-page article, and I was taking all these notes. And then at the end, it's like, the funny part is there's no ginger in ginger beef. And I was like, what? And I wait all the way to the end for the punchline. I guess that makes sense.
Sure.
I did the same thing. Also, I just want to throw in here, I have a really fond spot in my heart for Calgary because when I flew to Tokyo, I had two layovers, like, in separate parts of Calgary. Huh. And the people, very kind people at border control there, both laughed in my face when they're like, where are you going? And I was like, Tokyo. And they're like, why are you here? Why in the world are you at a layover in Calgary? And I was like, must have been cheap. I don't know.
Huh. Yeah, I guess it is kind of out of the way from Atlanta. But must have been cheap. Yeah.
It must have been. I think I had to go up to, like, I had three stops in Canada somehow. It was wild. But I got a lot of Tim Hortons, Timmy Ho-Ho's, as they say.
Oh, yeah.
So that was cool.
Oh, gosh. Mm-hmm. Canada is so high up on our list of places to visit whenever Americans finally get to travel again safely.
Yes.
We have just read and heard and been informed of so many amazing sounding dishes that I need to put in my face. So.
Yes. Yes. Oh, my gosh. And speaking of, like, send, like, as we said, anything with ginger that's popular where you are or that you like to make, we would love to hear from you. Any recipes or are these regional things that we personally love discovering? Send those our way.
Please, please, please. Always, always, always. Yeah.
Yes. And speaking of, we do have some listener mail for you.
Oh, we do. But first, we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with
Snow Mail.
Zing. I think of a ginger. See, I was going to do, I was like, should I do like a zing, like a burn? Or should I do like gingerly? But then you told me gingerly is not related to ginger. So you helped make my decision. I learned something today.
I like to think we both did.
I think so. I think so. And we hope you listeners did too. Sydney wrote, after listening to Savor for some time and enjoying your episode on butter a second time through, I finally decided to write in because I have some thoughts on this stuff. I know you said that making your own butter at home seems like too much work, but it really isn't as difficult as you might think. And I think it is truly worth the effort. The shake and jar technique is one way, but the best is to use a stand mixer. Not as much of an exercise for your arms, and you can do large quantities. Throw in the cream and let it whip through the whipped cream stage until the fat clumps up and sloshes around in the buttermilk. Be sure to drape a kitchen towel over the mixer. Remove the butter from the buttermilk and toss into a bowl of cold water in which you can knead it and remove all of the buttermilk. Keep changing out the water until it's pretty clear. And there you have it. Be sure to save the buttermilk for more deliciousness. And it's real true buttermilk, which is hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
I've also made cultured butter by letting the cream sit out on the counter for about a day and chilling it a bit before whipping. I think it's worth doing a large batch every once in a while and freezing separate portions of it. It will last forever. Maybe not worth using homemade butter for your baking needs, but putting it on your toast? Oh, yeah. Or make some compound butter with a little Dijon mustard, lemon zest, and juice, chives, and salt. Freeze it in little pads or in ice cube trays and throw that sucker on your steak. Feel like a fancy chef and have your mind blown.
Oh,
my mind is blown already.
Right? That sounds so delightful.
It sounds amazing. I love.
Now I'm like, why aren't I doing this?
I know. Okay. I love how many of you listeners have written in and been like, no, you can make your own butter. Here's how.
I see. I never, for some reason, after all of my bouts of marshmallow making in my stand mixer, I never thought to do the same thing with butter instead of, you know, gelatin and sugar.
Yeah. Let me tell you that promise of buttermilk, because.
Oh, yeah. So good.
So good.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well. Jolene wrote, a few years ago, I spent a year in Albania and more often than not picked up my dinner from the local creperie or pizza place. I spent some time working my way through the crepe menu, figuring this would be a great way to learn the words for the ingredients. Definitely the only reason. Some of these were obvious. Domate is tomato, prosciutto is prosciutto, or rather a generic term for cold cut. But one ingredient intrigued me because I couldn't immediately figure it out. Philadelphia. I finally ordered a crepe with Philadelphia and realized that it should have been completely obvious. Philadelphia is, of course, cream cheese. You should consider adding Albania to your list of foodie field trips. The food varies a lot regionally, despite Albania's small size, and the food is influenced by its Mediterranean neighbors, its Ottoman history, and a tiny smattering of Slavic fare. It makes for a unique dining experience and is definitely worth giving a try. And I should point out here that Philadelphia is spelled F-I-L-A-D-E-L-F-I-A. So it's a lot easier in text to be confused. I think that, yeah, my brain just went like, oh, sure, that's probably how you pronounce that. I didn't look these words up, by the way. If I've just really, really butchered them, I apologize.
but yeah, I do love that Philadelphia has become so ubiquitous. Like, oh,
internationally, right? Mm-hmm. Gosh, that's amazing.
And absolutely a trip to Albania. Oh, our list grows. It grows and grows.
But, you know,
that's not a bad problem to have.
No, that's a great problem.
Yes. Yes, and keep those suggestions coming. You can always email us, thanks to those two listeners who already did. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, where our handle is @SaverPod, and we do hope to hear from you. Saver is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.